And then I heard these footsteps in my kitchen. I didn't dare move. I hardly dared breathe. It could have been me, couldn't it?
What is it, Paul?
It's someone's hand.
It's someone's hand.
She must have had a weak heart, poor old girl. I had to stop her screaming, but I didn't mean to kill the old girl. You know what it is when a woman screams.
Murder Most Foul. Six forensic murder cases presented by Nick Ross. Case 1, The Fingerless Strangler.
It is a fundamental principle of English law that no person can be tried more than once for the same offence. There can, of course, be retrials where proceedings have had to be abandoned. But there can't be many people who've been charged with murder and gone to trial three times. It's Sunday, November the 28th, 1943. The war still rages, with V1 doodlebugs regularly droning overhead, cutting out, followed by a silence, and then the blast of high explosive. Portsmouth has been hit hard, but the spirit of the Blitz survives. And especially when big ships from the Navy are in port, pubs do a healthy trade. At the John Barleycorn and Commercial Road, Mrs. Robinson, the landlady, has locked up for the night. Her takings are kept, as ever, and, as was widely known, in two handbags she always kept beside her. This evening she must have over £400. The night passes, and in the morning Mrs. Robinson's handbags are empty, and Mrs. Robinson is dead.
Ah, Dr. Simpson, yes?
Yes.
Detective Inspector Lamport, Portsmouth City Police. Quite a mess, hmm?
Quite a mess. Let's have a look at her.
Looks as though she's put up a fight. What do you think, Doctor?
She was strangled. Look here, these bruises, this big one here, right on the voice box, probably from the thumb, and that's an impression from the thumbnail. And then there's these three bruises in a line, though there aren't any marks from the fingernails.
There's some scratch marks there on the neck.
Well, that could have been her attacker, or they could have been from her own nails trying to pull his hands off. How did he get in?
Broke a window downstairs, and he left by the back door. We're looking for prints.
There's an injury here. Now, she could have hit her head on the windowsill, so her attacker came into the room. There was a struggle.
She pulls down the blackout curtain, trying to get the window open to call for help.
Then she falls, or she's pulled, and hits her head on the windowsill, before she's dragged right away from the window. The attacker then sits or kneels astride her body and strangles her.
There's a neighbour, sir. She's downstairs. It's a Mrs. Smitherson. Lives two doors away. She sleeps downstairs in the front room with her little boy because of the bombing. Mrs. Smitherson!
Mrs. Smitherson, Detective Inspector Lamport. The constable says...
She's dead, isn't she? Well, it could have been me, you see.
Well, tell me.
Well, about 2 a.m, there was this banging on the kitchen window at the back. Well, it was terrifying. And then I heard these footsteps in my kitchen. I didn't dare move. I hardly dared breathe.
And then?
Well, then, nothing. Until about 2:30, when I heard footsteps again. At this time, they was going down the passage, down the side of the house, round to the front. Well, in the end, about 3 a.m, I had to know what was going on, so I climbed out the front window.
You're a brave woman, Mrs. Smitherson.
Well, between my house and here, there was a motor car with 4 men in it. I got straight back inside, got into bed and just prayed they hadn't seen me.
Have you checked your house?
There's nothing taken, but he was in there all right. See, my blackout's a great big piece of plywood. I found that broken and lying outside. And the kitchen table was moved, and the back door was unbolted. Could have been me, couldn't it?
It could indeed have been Mrs. Smitherson who was murdered. But it seems the intruder, or intruders, realised that they'd broken into the wrong house and moved on to their intended quarry, with awful consequences instead for Mrs. Robinson. No fingerprints were found, and no further clues of any sort, save one. Beneath the broken window pane at the rear of the John Barleycorn was found a small black button with a piece of thread attached. Had this perhaps been ripped from the coat of the attacker? And if so, could it eventually be matched? It wasn't much to go on. Now further door-to-door inquiries were made, known villains were interviewed, local informers were questioned, but nothing came to light. It was nearly a month later, and 70 miles away, that two police constables, in plain clothes, happened to be walking down Waterloo Road in southeast London. They were on the lookout for people trading in stolen property.
What about him?
Where?
Missed him. He's just gone in the calf. Couple of shoes under his arm.
Come on, then.
No, I didn't say you'd want them, but do you know anyone who would? Come on, pair of shoes, 25 bob. It's not bad, is it?
Excuse me, I'm a police officer.
Oh, are you? Well, me brother sent them to me for Christmas. They're too big for me. And if you're not satisfied, I'll go with you to the station.
The man was Harold Luffins, a well-known crook, though not a notably successful one. 28 of his 47 years had already been spent in prison. The constables cautioned him, told him he was being taken in for custody for suspected unlawful possession of the shoes, and began to walk him towards Kennington Road police station. On the way, he began to talk.
Shoes! I'm wanted for things far more serious than that. The Yard wants me. It's trapdoor for me now. I'm glad you've picked me up. Here.
I don't want your cigarette case.
Oh, it's yours. It's silver. Christmas box for you. I know this will be my last Christmas.
Put him in a cell.
I've been through hell for the past 3 weeks.
And shut him up.
Sarge.
I've been a bastard all my life.
Go on, down the end.
And I'll finish the way I've lived. I was sorry for it the moment I'd done it. I've had no sleep since. It's preying on me mind. She must have had a weak heart, poor old girl. I had to stop her screaming, but I didn't mean to kill the old girl. You know what it is when a woman screams. I strangled the old woman in beer house.
Baker.
Sarge?
I don't know what all that's about, but get a statement of him.
Right, Sarge.
It wasn't long before police from Portsmouth arrived, and a whole series of statements from Harold Luffins ensued, each more accurate, it seemed, than the last. Mr. Luffins was then taken to Portsmouth, where Detective Inspector Lamport was back on the case, now assisted by Detective Sergeant Atkins.
He can only have known those details if he was the murderer, or at least if he was there.
Or if he knew someone who was there. Look, let's go through it again. He got the date, easy. He got climbing over the wall at the back.
And getting into the wrong house and getting out again.
He got the getting in through a window into the bar, going into several rooms, coming across a woman in the back room, grabbing her by the throat with his right hand.
Her falling by the window, the blackout coming down.
Holding her on the floor and putting a piece of cloth over her face, and he gets the getaway right.
Including seeing this woman come out of the house just down the road.
Correct.
Now, how is anyone going to know, or why is anyone going to tell him that sort of detail? And get it right, if he wasn't the killer.
So we charge him with murder.
We charge him with murder.
The confession certainly seemed solid. And further evidence soon came to light, thanks to examinations carried out by Mr. Walls of the Metropolitan Police Laboratory. A welt in Luffin's left boot was found to carry a tiny piece of undyed hemp and a fibre of green wool. Each matched materials of two different mats in Mrs. Robinson's bedroom. Then, in Luffin's right coat sleeve, a tiny feather was found, matching the feathers in Mrs. Robinson's eiderdown. Finally, Harold Luffin's had a notable physical characteristic which particularly interested Keith Simpson.
What is it, Detective Inspector?
Well, you remember the exact marks left on the woman's neck?
Impressions from the fingers and a thumbnail mark, plus some light scratch marks. Probably the victim trying to pull him off.
Well, this man Luffins had an accident in a brickyard 30 years ago.
And?
He lost all but the stumps of his fingers on his right hand, but kept the thumb.
Well, we'll have to check the span, but otherwise...
It explains the marks.
Yes, it does. Very nicely indeed.
The case was beginning to seem straightforward. Then, on January the 6th, 1944, Harry Luffins asked to see the governor of the prison where he was on remand. He declared he was not guilty of the charge, and that he could prove it.
But I put it to you, what stronger evidence could there be than not just a confession, but an unsolicited confession, and a confession full of the most precise details? If the accused is in fact innocent, why did he confess? And if your answer to that is a whim, a desire for notoriety, a perverse pleasure in publicity of any sort, well then, You are left with the question, how could such a man, motivated to false confession in such a way, have known all the various details which he correctly described in statement after statement?
Well, I read about it.
You read about it?
In paper, in News of the World.
And that gave sufficient details, did it?
More or less, yes, it did.
Well, I have here copies of press coverage of the murder. And if I may read from the News of the World, my lord?
Carry on.
The only details given relating to the interior of the house are as follows. Mrs. Robinson had been strangled in a bedroom, which was in great disorder. Nearly £400 had been stolen. This hardly compares with the admirably precise details given in your confession, does it?
Oh, I got the rest from the police themselves.
Oh, don't tell me.
Well, every time they interrogated me, they let slip more and more bits of what went on. So every statement I made, I put in a bit more at detail. Till by the end, I got it about all right, didn't I?
But the two constables to whom you made your first statements were members of the Metropolitan Police. And they wouldn't have known any of the details themselves, now, would they?
How would I know? I got it all from them. That night, the night of murder, I spent all night in a tube station, Warren Street. I'd got nothing to do with killing that woman.
John Maud, KC, for the defence, pointed out that the statements made to the London police contained some inaccuracies, while the statements to the Portsmouth police did not. Perhaps there'd been some improving of the confession, which must cast doubt on the credibility of the confessions as a whole. But still, the facts seemed stark enough for a conviction. The supporting evidence, while not particularly strong, was at least helpful, and Dr. Keith Simpson explained to the court how Luffins might have strangled Mrs. Robinson.
Despite the mutilation to the hand, I believe it could have made the marks found on the dead woman's throat.
So the span of the hand was sufficient?
It was, and the marks correspond. Only the thumb of the defendant's hand has a nail. It is only the thumb mark on the throat that showed a scratch. Probably a nail scratch.
But with the fingers being only stumps, Doctor, would they be strong enough to strangle a woman?
Yes, I certainly believe they would. In fact, the elementary principle of the lever would make it possible to apply greater pressure with the stumps than with fingers of normal length.
Thank you, Doctor.
Now, Doctor, I'm going to quote, if I may, from Gray's Anatomy. You are, of course, familiar with Gray?
I'm certainly familiar with particular parts of it, but no one can be expected to know every line of such a tome.
Very well. I am going to quote a certain section on the origin and attachment of the lumbrical, is that how you say it, Doctor? The lumbrical muscles to the fingers.
May I know the edition from which you are quoting?
Of course, Doctor. It's, yes, the 28th edition.
Oh, I'm so sorry, but that is an out-of-date edition.
Are you sure?
I'm afraid so. I have the more recent edition at home.
No, I can't have counsel quoting out-of-date textbooks in this court.
In fact, Dr. Simpson had just the previous day received a complimentary copy of the latest edition of the work prior to its publication. His cross-examination came to nothing, and the strength of the prosecution case was undiminished. But then came witnesses for the defence.
And you're sure it was the accused, Harold Luffins?
Yes, I'm sure. We often have to go down Warren Street when the raids are on, and I noticed him that night. I remember him well. I'm sure it was the last Sunday in November. He come down into the station and we sort of got chatting. Eventually, he finished up nursing my baby for me for a while, and that's when I noticed his hands, his fingers.
What about his hand?
Well, his right hand, his fingers are all stumps. And he told me he come from Huddersfield, which he does, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And what happened next, Mrs. Jones?
Well, about 20 past midnight, he turned in for the night. I showed him a bunk that wasn't being used. It was just two bunks along from where I was. And then about 5 to 3, I had to get up for the baby. And I saw him asleep. And I put my raincoat on him. And then it must have been about 5:15, I saw him again. And he was still sleeping. I'm sure it was him.
There followed similar evidence from a Mrs. Rachel Pickering and a Miss Edith Thatcher. Despite pressure from the prosecution, none of these witnesses would waver on the identification of Luffins or on the date, though Caswell did emphasise how hard it must be to pin down one night in a tube station as opposed to any other. But then came two employees of the London Passenger Transport Board.
Yes, I was in Warren Street Station that night.
And were there many people down there whom you knew, Mr. Ryecroft? Regulars?
Oh, yes.
And did they include Mrs. Alice Jones, Mrs. Rachel Pickering, and Miss Edith Thatcher?
Oh, yes, all of them.
And the man you now know to be Mr. Harold Luffins, of whom I believe you have now been shown a photograph?
I have been, yes.
Can you point him out to me in this court?
Yes, him over there, the man in the dock. He'd got four fingers missing on his right hand.
And was he in Warren Street Station that night?
Yes, he was.
And you are a ganger in the employment of the London Passenger Transport Board?
That's right.
And you've brought with you a record of works, have you not?
Yes, I have.
And consulting that record of works, Mr. Bull, can you tell me which nights in November Mr. James Ryecroft was on duty at Warren Street Station?
I can. It shows here that Mr. Ryecroft was only at Warren Street on one night, and that was the night of the 28th of November.
So, whoever he saw at that station in that period, he must have seen on that particular night.
That's right, yes.
Being a jury member in a murder trial can never be easy. But for these men and women, it must have been particularly tough. They were now faced, on the one hand, with a confession backed by some forensic evidence, and on the other, an unusually strong alibi. Perhaps, in these circumstances, it wasn't surprising when the jury failed to agree upon their verdict. A retrial was fixed to take place at the Old Bailey 2 weeks later. This second trial followed much the same course as the first, but this time the pathologist, Dr. Keith Simpson, was cross-examined rather more thoroughly by the defence.
And in my view, Harold Luffin's hand was perfectly capable of the act of strangulation.
Despite the fingers on that hand being only stumps.
With the full weight of his body behind that hand, I don't see that he would have had any difficulty.
The full weight of his body behind these stumps of fingers.
That is right.
I see. You must have examined the right hand of the defendant very closely indeed.
As closely as necessary.
But you have examined it. You have held his hand in yours.
I have examined a plaster cast of the accused's hand and also some photographs.
Ah, a plaster cast and some photographs. Thank you, Dr. Simpson.
This turned out to be preparation for the defence to play its strongest, yet most unexpected, card. The great Sir Bernard Spilsbury was called as a defence witness. Sir Bernard was one of the most renowned pathologists of his day, though now nearing the end of his career. His fame was tremendous, and his pronouncements often were taken as unquestionable truths. Yet, in this case, he'd not seen the victim's body, not performed an autopsy, nor had he inspected any of the medical or scientific evidence. It was difficult for the prosecution to envisage what even Sir Bernard could contribute to the defence.
And did you, Sir Bernard, visit the defendant in Brixton Prison?
I did.
And could you please tell the court the purpose of that visit?
It was in order to examine the right hand of the defendant, which I did. It was obvious to me, as soon as I saw the hand, that it would have been quite impossible to have exerted any pressure at all with such fingers.
And were you able to test this?
I asked the defendant to grip my hand with all the strength he had.
What was the strength of that handshake, Sir Bernard?
It was limp and flabby. I do not believe he could strangle anyone with that hand.
Yet we have heard from Dr. Keith Simpson that on the basis of the principle of leverage, the defendant might in fact have been able to exert extra pressure with the stubs of his fingers.
I see no credibility whatever in such a hypothesis.
Sir Bernard, I realise that you are very experienced in these matters, but do you not concede the possibility that on this occasion there may have been an error of judgment?
I do not.
Here we have a man accused on a charge of murder by strangling, and he is asked to demonstrate the strength of his hand. Might such a man not be tempted to grip your hand, Sir Bernard, with less than all the strength he could muster?
I am convinced that those fingers are useless.
Sir Bernard, I wonder, are you aware of exactly when the accident to which you referred took place?
Not the exact year, no.
Or approximately how long ago?
No.
Well, let me tell you, Sir Bernard, it happened over 30 years ago. Now, surely over such a period, the accused will have gained considerable experience in the use of that limb.
That is possible, yes.
And could that not have extended to the use of this limb to end the life of Mrs. Robinson?
It could not.
And that was as much of a concession as could be wrung from Sir Bernard Spilsbury. The prosecution had one last try. They applied to Mr. Justice Castles to present additional evidence obtained by the police concerning Harry Luffin's alibi. The judge refused. He said the prosecution should have applied to present it at an earlier stage of the proceedings. And that was that. The verdict was not guilty. As Harold Luffins descended the steps of the Old Bailey, he was rearrested, but this time for a robbery with violence committed in St. Albans, a charge on which he was subsequently convicted. In the course of that crime, Harry Luffins had managed to use his hand to tie an old woman to a bed using the flex of an electric fire, and had used his right hand in particular to wave a crutch at his victim. But that was incidental. He'd been acquitted of the Portsmouth murder. And for years to come, Harry Luffins continued to spend his life more in prison than out of it.
Hey, Luffins, have you seen this?
What?
You're a nastier bit of work than I thought. You're in the People, mate. Extracts from the autobiography of the renowned barrister J.D. Caswell.
Give it here.
Murder of some old woman back in the war. Says here you were lucky to get off.
Oh, they found me not guilty.
Here you are. Could it be that the alibi was purely a contrived cover? Hold on. But Harold Luffins was found not guilty of the odious crime for which he twice stood trial. It may be that the views I have on the exclusion of my additional evidence are of little consequence now, but I can assure you that they are very strong indeed. He's saying you did it, but you got off.
That certainly seemed to be what the article was saying. And now, 16 years after the trial, Luffins decided to sue. The editor of the Times had, after all, been acquitted of the murder. So no doubt he expected a straightforward out-of-court settlement. Through his solicitors, that is indeed what he attempted to negotiate. J.T. Maloney, QC, and Hugh Davidson were engaged on behalf of the defendants and met with them in conference.
I'd say we have a good chance. Sir Bernard Spilsbury has died for a start, and whoever they produce to test Luffin's hand grip won't have the same authority as Spilsbury. Besides which, we're talking about the grip of a man 20 years ago. Very hard to judge now.
Well, yes, I mean, that is a good start.
And then the rules of the game are different. We can mention Luffin's string of previous convictions, which couldn't be mentioned at the criminal trial, of course, including a number of violent crimes.
Yeah, you're beginning to persuade me.
And then there's the evidence which Caswell wasn't allowed to present at the Old Bailey. You remember? Mm-hmm. The investigation of his alibi of having spent the night in the tube station. Well?
And so it was that a civil case brought by Luffins himself became the very last thing he could have wanted. In effect, yet another trial for the same offence of murder. But the roles were now reversed. Luffins was having to prove his case rather than throw doubt on the prosecution's version of events. Remarkably, almost all the original witnesses were traced successfully, and nearly all of them were still alive. Two new medical experts were called in to take the place of Sir Bernard Spilsbury, but inevitably they were rather less effective. Then there came the evidence collected by the police, which the previous judge had disallowed.
And could you tell us, Detective Sergeant, the nature of this evidence?
Well, yes. Luffin's alibi was that he had spent the night at Warren Street Underground Station in London. And as the murder had been committed in Portsmouth, over 60 miles away, he couldn't possibly be the murderer.
Please continue.
Well, there were four people who said they had seen him there that night. Two of them London Transport employees. But only one of those four had any recollection of seeing Mr. Luffins between 12:30 a.m. and 5:15 a.m. Now, if that lady isn't, how should I say, impartial, or if she just made a mistake, well, then there's a hole of nearly 5 hours.
And would that have been sufficient time to have gone to Portsmouth, commit the crime, and return?
I believe it would, yes, sir.
Even in wartime, with the blackout?
We tested it then when the war was still on, before the second trial. Another officer and myself drove from Warren Street Tube Station to the John Barleycorn in Portsmouth and back again, blackout and all, sir. We had 4¾ hours to do it in, and we did it.
But only just, presumably.
No, we did it comfortably, and with 30 minutes to spare, which we spent in a public house.
So you are suggesting, Detective Sergeant, that the plaintiff Luffins could have gone to the Tube Station, made sure he was noticed, then driven to Portsmouth and back, and then could be safely back, ready to be seen in bed again by first light?
Yes, sir, I think that would be possible.
Finally, when the case came to an end after a fortnight of hearing evidence, Mr. Justice Gorman addressed the foreman of the jury.
Did the words mean that the plaintiff was guilty of the murder of Rose Ada Robinson?
Yea.
Were the words true in substance and in fact?
Yea.
So, after three trials, a jury was finally convinced of Harold Luffin's guilt. Yet even this isn't the end of the story. 4 years later, that's 20 years after the murder, in May 1963, Harry Luffins made his way to the offices of the People newspaper.
Mr. Luffins, to what do I owe the privilege? Have you come here to attempt to sue us again? We would be delighted.
No, I haven't.
Or to protest your innocence, perhaps?
No, I've come here to... They tell me I've got cancer and I haven't got long to live. Before I die, I want to make a confession. I want to say I've done that job.
What?
I did kill that woman in the public house in Portsmouth. I got there and back in a stolen jeep.
Are you willing to put that in writing, sign it?
That's what I come here for.
In The Fingerless Strangler, Keith Drinkle played Dr. Keith Simpson and Eric Allen played Harold Luffins. Other parts were played by Brett Usher, John Evitts, Geraldine Fitzgerald, John Fleming, Barry J. Gordon, Dominic Letts, Jilly Mears, David Thorpe, James Telfer, Jonathan Adams, and John Webb. Murder Most Foul was written by Rib Davis and presented by Nick Ross. The producer was Fiona MacLean.